Hi, Suzanne. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. To say that I'm excited to be talking to you about this topic is not the right way to put it, but I'm hoping that you and I can maybe, and our viewers, if you're watching live, I'm going to be taking comments on the Facebook live video as best I can. So you can make comment and I will try to bring you in. But we've just been having all of these shootings, schools, concerts, churches, and there's just points where I feel, Suzanne, that there's nothing we can do about it. It's just all feels so overwhelming. And that's why these students at the high school in Florida are giving me hope, because they are not falling into a sense of despair. They are falling into a sense of action. They're doing something with their grief and their anger that hopefully will make the world a better place and is inspiring many of us to do something. So.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting moment because they're speaking as victims. They're claiming, unfortunately, the privilege to speak as victims. It's an unfortunate choice of words, but it means by that, when we say the privilege of that position, it means that they have a special access to the truth of a situation that maybe the rest of us are not don't have access to.
Yeah, there was one. I mean, Saturday was just so moving as well, as all of these students were shown at these rallies, right? And one of them said, if politicians aren't going to do anything about it, then it's up to us, the victims, to do something about it. And others, so some of them have used the term victim, others have used the term survivor. We're the survivor of this shootings, and we have a responsibility to do something about it. So they've used both terms.
Well, yeah,
And
because
I think the trouble with using the term we're the victim is that you can fall into this woe is me victim mentality, which they aren't doing. These students, they don't seem to have a victimary mentality about what happened.
right. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Of course, they're survivors because most victims don't survive. They're, like you say, they're either killed or they're silenced because they take on the identity that their oppressors are offering to them or forcing on them, which is that they aren't worthy to speak. They don't deserve a place to be heard in society. And so a victim identity, even if you survive physically, means that you're silenced spiritually and emotionally, and marginalized by the culture. And so these survivors are refusing to be marginalized. And it's very moving to me, especially because, they're demanding that society fulfill its responsibility to children. And not just give lip service to the fact that children are important to us and that we love our children and we're concerned about our children. But yet, if our rights are coming up against what needs to be done for our children, we rather defend our rights than accept our responsibilities in this situation. I think that's what these young people are trying to say is that your rights are important, but you have a responsibility to us. And until you live up to it, we're not going to be quiet. So I think it really is an important moment in this whole trying to get off the paralysis of the gun debate that we're locked in right now. and maybe they can move us through that paralysis. It would be great.
And sadly, we are seeing people trying to silence these students today and yesterday. There are, I don't know, people on the far right wing media, I guess, I don't know, who are saying that they're paid crisis actors, right? Or they're working for the FBI, because one of the kids' dads is a retired FBI agent. So, you know, and there's Dinesh D'Souza, who tweets out after yesterday, the Florida House of Representatives voted against even talking about doing something about the AR-15 rifle. They wouldn't even talk about it. It was down party lines, like 71 Republicans voted against even talking about it, and 30 Democrats said, yeah, we should talk about this. But they won't even talk about it. And so after that, Dinesh D'Souza tweets out, adults one, students zero. It's just this like totally absurd mocking of the victim, of trying to silence the voice of the survivors in this. And I'm almost in shock. I shouldn't be. I should be expecting this, because that's what happens when you try to rise up against the darkness in the world, is that the darkness will come after you. And the way that these kids are responding to that is also very inspiring. Like, they don't seem to me to be motivated by revenge or out to get these people who are trying to silence them. They're just speaking their truth. They're just speaking up inside of it. So it's very inspiring.
It is very powerful. And as you say, not surprising at all that attempts would be made to silence survivors. You know, they physically survived, but to tell the truth about violence, the violence in our culture, is gonna bring that, the ugliness out to try and silence you again. And I just think it's so that, you know, the symbolism is almost like too obvious so that it's not even a symbol anymore. But those that are insisting on the right to bear arms, you know, Renee talks about the fact that in a scapegoating situation, what the community is trying to do is expel its violence outward onto a victim, right, and blame the victim for the discord in the community. And so the community is trying to pretend that we don't have any problems except for you. We're not violent. You're the ones that are violent. And our community just wants to wear, concealed or not concealed, symbols of the collective violence. You know, humans bear collective responsibility for violence, and we're wearing it literally on our waist, the symbol of the violent culture in which we live and which we're trying to pretend doesn't hurt anybody. And anyone who says it's harming someone must be a stooge of some, right, left-wing conspiracy. You know, it's beyond metaphor at this point. It's like literal.
yeah. And it's so overwhelming, as you say. Like, when you want to really get at the heart of this issue, it is about, for me, it is about these guns that are meant to kill as many people as quickly as possible. That is part of the issue. But the bigger issue is the culture of violence. That is just everywhere in our culture. And that's the part of it that's overwhelming. Like, the underlying issue is, hey, you hit us, we're going to hit you back. That's it. You offend me, I'm going to get you back in some way. It's just the way that our culture runs. And it's not just US culture, it's human culture in general. But that's the infection that we need to get at, that's underlying these issues. So yes, we need to deal with whether or not this gun should be in civilian hands. But we also need to deal with the bigger underlying issue, because it could be the AR-15 this week, it could be whatever it is the next week. And as some people say, you know, you could even use a knife to kill people. Well, yes, that's true. But I would rather we have knives that can kill fewer people than AR-15s that can kill massive amounts of people in 30 seconds.
Yeah. No, I mean, the issue of, you know, you pointed it out very well in your article on this issue that, you know, just common sense safety regulations about background checks and licensing. I mean, right now we do not have, you know, we don't treat guns as effectively as we treat driver's licenses. You know, you can get a car, but you have to be a certain age, you have to pass tests, you have to be licensed. You can't just walk in somewhere and buy a car if you're not properly licensed, which you can do with guns. And so it's just, you know, at this point, it's because these are just common sense things, you know, you have to ask yourself what's going on. And for me, it's particularly poignant to me that it's children that are involved, because I really think children are, you know, pervasively, they are scapegoated by our culture, because, you know, adults run things, and we run things according to our needs and what we value and what's important for us. And children and young adults need very different types of environments and very different types of cultures and approaches. And so, but we don't really acknowledge the different needs that children have. And we sort of force them into to meeting our needs. And so, you know, to me, that's we're not keeping our children safe in schools. We're not keeping them safe when they're walking to and from schools. We're not keeping them safe whether they're in a suburban setting or an urban setting. And on the front page of the Times today, alongside the grieving children from Parkland, were the wounded and suffering children in Syria. And so there, children are the victims of adults' need to, as you say, to assert ourselves, to get even, to do whatever it is, to have power, whatever it is. The children are the voiceless victims. And until we begin to structure our decision-making process around what children need as well as what adults need, we're going to be stuck here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned my article. I had one comment. Well, I had a couple of comments on it, but I had one comment that especially struck me. It was from a priest who was the principal of a school for what gets labeled as troubled teens. So when schools kick out their students, like the one who was kicked out in Florida, those students would go to his school. And he said that he was a teacher there for 10 years and then the principal there for 20 years or something. And he said, I never felt threatened by any of my students, because he said that he would go outside as they were coming in the morning and he would talk with them. He would say, "Good morning, everyone." And he would build a relationship with them. And he would, it was a way for him to honor them.
Yeah.
And not treat them as somebody who's a nuisance or who's out to get him. He wasn't afraid of them, although I probably would be. but he went out to them and built a relationship with them. And that's what I think is largely missing in our culture of violence. Okay. Not just at schools, but prison industrial complex and all of these things. We think that might makes right, that it's my will against your will, and we're just in this clash of generations, class of race, clash of whatever the category is. And this priest models for us a different way of being in the world, a way that's not over and against somebody, but is with the other in a way that that says we're in this together.
Exactly. And I think there's, you know, more than one such teacher and principal in America that are working very hard with the children, but are fighting against bureaucracies that are more geared towards control and ranking people, whether it's the students or the teachers or whatever it is. I was reading somewhere where state governments pass all these kinds of regulations about reading requirements and testing and everything without ever consulting one teacher.
Yeah.
I was just kind of blown away. And again, teachers are the ones closest to the children who could give voice to this unheard population, and they're being silenced.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's frightening how effective it can be. And the other point you raised in your article, which I really want to talk to you about, is this the question that's raised by mimetic theory about the unanimity minus one.
Yeah.
You know, that how when you see unanimity, you're probably witnessing a scapegoating. And you address that on the gun issue.
You know, it's one of the issues in mimetic theory that I think needs to be explored a lot more, because there's a certain sense of a victim mentality that can happen when we begin to discover that, oh, a bunch of people are telling me one thing and they're uniting against me, and that makes me this like prophet, because I must be telling the truth. Otherwise people wouldn't be uniting against me. But sometimes I think that the people who are saying these things might be telling the truth. Like, it's not about you being right. There are times when the mob isn't a mob out for violence. The mob is a source of truth. It's much more of a community that is trying to love you through whatever it is that you're going through, although you may not see it as love because they're telling the truth, and the truth will set you free, but first it might piss you off a whole lot. So I think that to me is what is happening. When I wrote that article, it was stemmed from these reports that 90% of Americans want stricter gun regulations, background checks, and these kinds of things. And, you know, somebody who's read Girard maybe superficially would say, oh, that's a mob. That 90% is going after the 10%, because that's what large groups of people do who agree on anything. And that's not true. It's not even true for Girard. Girard says in Deceit, Desire, in the novel, he talks about a character in The Red and the Black. Who wrote that book? I can't remember.
Stendhal.
Stendhal, yeah. And Girard says that there's a character in there who believes so firmly in a lie that the whole world could unite in telling him the truth about it, and he would still not be able to listen to the truth. Right. So here's an example of, like, obviously this is hyperbole, like everybody could come and tell the truth and be so firmly steeped in a lie that you're not able to hear it. So it's not always the case that a large group of people united in something is a mob that's out for violence. It could be a community that's telling the truth. And Jesus goes in this direction too. I think it's in Matthew 18, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
so go ahead.
Well, yeah. And that's a poignant passage for me, because it follows his discussion about children and not causing children to stumble, and how God reacts when even one child is lost. And it's some of Jesus' harshest language in the Bible. It's, you know, if you put a stumbling block in front of one of these little ones, it would be better if you put a millstone around your neck and drowned yourself in the sea. You know, it's just pretty harsh. But he, and so again, you know, I think this is Jesus trying to talk about the not just the helplessness of children, but that they depend on us, they rely on us, and we have a responsibility to them. But then he goes on to talk about, so what happens if you have a problem with a member of your community? First, you go and talk to him. If he won't listen, take someone with you. If he still won't listen, take a group. Go to the whole church. And if he still won't listen, you got to shake the dust off your feet and say bye-bye. But there, yeah. Jesus is saying that the whole community can be a bearer, a witness to truth that you don't necessarily want to hear. And I think that the key to telling the difference between a mob and a community is the source of the group's identity. You know, so a mob is getting its identity by being against the thing it's trying to expel or silence or whatever. A community draws its identity from the recognition that we're all victimizers. We're all scapegoaters without knowing it. You know, the Christian calling is to be a constantly repenting scapegoater. Not to say, hey, I'm not a scapegoater anymore, because then you fall into this, but you are. And so all of this is becomes a way to justify your own goodness and your own being against someone. Yeah. So mobs are seeking to expel, to be against. Communities are trying to include and expand the circle of people that belong, right?
Yeah, it's an incredibly tough line between telling the truth and scapegoating someone, right? It's an incredibly tough line. Like, right after the shooting last week, President Trump gives a speech where he refuses to even use the word gun. Right. And he says this is a mental health issue, mm-hmm. right? And I'm not denying that there are mental health issues going on. I think if we're going to blame mental health, it's much bigger than what we think it is, because our mental health issue is violence itself. And the idea that we can use violence in order to solve the problem of violence is part of our big mental health issues that we need to deal with. But, you know, for him to not even use the word guns in it, the guns are part of the problem, was just like, I don't know. I just didn't know like how to deal with it. And to tell the, like, he needs to, these are things that he needs to deal with, right? Like this needs to be part of the conversation. And that's why students were rising up and saying, hey, if Trump isn't even going to talk about guns after this massive shooting, then we're going to have to do it. You know, it's also, as we were talking earlier, all of these far right wing pundits who are going after these kids, I am having a really hard time not hating them.
Yeah.
At the moment, I'm having a really hard time not just completely despising Dinesh D'Souza for mocking these children who have just gone through this tragedy, and for these other people who say, oh, they're just paid actors.
Right. It's. As you say, it's a mental health issue because it's an inability to stay in touch with reality. You know, it's like they're captive to a delusional way of thinking about violence that blinds them to reality. I mean, and that's one of the frightening things when you're caught up in a mimetic rivalry and a mimetic contest. Mm-hmm. You do actually lose touch with reality. I mean, we say the truth, but we're here talking about a concrete event that happened and you can't even know it. Like,
right.
You know. So that becomes, as you say, a mental health issue that a big part of our culture is caught up in. And I think to, with integrity and honesty, call that out, we have to at the same time always ask, well, where am I out of touch with reality? As I'm approaching you with a sense of compassion and grief that you're really so out of touch with things that you need some help, where do I need help too? So that we always see someone else's scapegoat, we never see our own. And so that's where we can help each other. Like, I can see your scapegoat. Trust me. Mm-hmm. It's very clear to me. But I can't see my own. And that's where I need you to say, trust me, I know your scapegoat, you don't. But well, that's where we need community.
I, for better or worse, I label myself as a liberal progressive. And I know, as you were saying earlier, so much of our identity is based on having an enemy, on being over and against someone.
Yeah.
That's where I find myself often going with Donald Trump. After he gives this speech and never mentions the word gun, I'm just totally pissed off at him. Yeah. Right? Like, how could you not even mention this? But later, he starts saying, well, maybe we should start looking at the gun issue. Right? The last couple of days, he says, I'm open to doing some more background checks and looking into this. Mm-hmm. This morning, people were talking about his sort of about face on this, or his maybe we should look into this. Mm-hmm. And maybe they were being realistic in saying he's not serious about it. Maybe they were being realistic and saying he's just giving lip service to this. But part of me, if I'm not going to base my identity against Trump, is to hope that he is being serious. And I'm not naively hoping, mm-hmm. but holding him to account for this, which is hard to do because, as many people point out, it often depends on the last person that he's talking with. But mm-hmm. that's, again, my way of scapegoating him, right? So it's just like this whole political situation is, it's like we're living in the myth, and you don't know who to trust and what to do. So,
yeah. And, you know, being in politics, it's a very difficult place to be, because when you have power, you're a target all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the children are scapegoats because they're silent. They're an ignored part of our culture. But someone who's at the top is a potential victim because everyone's gunning for him. And so to occupy a position of power with some sort of grace is a very, very difficult thing to do. And political power is just very, it's just very about manipulating public opinion so you don't become the next scapegoat victim. That's all it is. It's you're trying to keep the mob focused somewhere else so that they look at you with loving glances while you're pointing, you know, at someone else. And so it's the art of scapegoating. I get that. I really do. And so I'm sympathetic to politicians because they're trapped inside a system that is structured around the scapegoat mechanism. It is just what it is. Now, what can we do? I think you have the right approach when you say, let's listen for the things that we want to hear and support that. Let's, you know, not gang up again. You know, we can get caught up getting ticked off about every other thing that he says. It's very easy to do. Even his supporters wish he would stop, you know, with the tweeting already. But he does, you know, it's like catching someone doing good and then supporting.
Yep.
And that's how you find the good and support it.
I like that. We've got a couple of comments, but I think that's a great way to end. So I'll read a couple comments that we have.
Sure.
Deborah Holden says, just says, hello. Well, so, Matt, hi, Deborah. Thank you. Lindsay says, I love the distinction between mob and community. I think that I think there's a lot more that could be done within mimetic theory circles on exploring that issue. Maura says, the students expected adults to protect them. Since we failed them, they have realized they are on their own. Fortunately, they are lobbying for their own protection. Mm-hmm. Yep, that sums it up. That sums it up. So, and they will not be silenced. So,
yeah, and they, so and good they for them. They won't be on their own either.
Yeah, yeah, there, yeah. So, awesome. Well, thank you, Suzanne, for this conversation. Yeah. I feel more hopeful now after having it with you. So, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Awesome. All right, and thank you everybody for watching. This will be posted on the Raven Foundation Facebook page and on the Raven Review website. If you feel so inclined, feel free to share it with others. All right, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.